John Dornbos joins us on Sports Byline. He played his college ball at Texas El Paso, and he was picked up by the Buffalo Bills as a free agent in 2003. He was a long snapper who spent 14 seasons in the NFL playing for the Tennessee Titans, Philadelphia Eagles, and the New Orleans Saints. And the Eagles traded him to the Saints in 2017, but his NFL career ended in 2017 due to a life-threatening heart condition. But the Eagles won Super Bowl 52 and presented John with an honorary Super Bowl ring. Take me back to growing up and how you ended up playing your college ball at Texas El Paso. And what were the influences in your life, John?
I mean, you're going to go way back here, and there's a lot of people that were influences in my life. All the friends I had, the coaches I had, my aunt that raised me, my grandparents, my sister. And so, ultimately I met a magician by the name of Ken Sands that my aunt introduced me to, who became a mentor to me. And when I got into the magic side of it, he taught me not necessarily just a trick, but more that, life is magic and that everything around us is magic. And that as a magician, this is really cool. As a magician, there's a theory that you could never mess up, that if the crowd doesn't know what to expect, you just keep rolling with it. And if it turns into a comedy bit because the whole trick went wrong, then so be it, but just entertain them. And he taught me so much more about being a performer. Then I had a junior college coach, Coach Hay, who, was a coach that influenced me, that taught me the game, that made me realize that the name on the back of our jersey means so much more than just your name. And it means that when people watch you play and they see how you react in certain situations, that's who you are. So if a play goes wrong and you stand up and you pick your teammate up and you rally and you figure it out, you go out and you have success, well, then you're a problem solver. If you complain and point your finger at officials, then guess what? Your name, that's what you represent. You're nothing but a finger pointer and a complainer. And so then I got to go to University of Texas, El Paso, and play Division I football with my best friend, Paul Tessier, which was amazing. And then I got lucky enough that I was a long snapper in college, and I was, I guess, better than some of the other guys. Still wasn't great. And I ended up making it and got to go into my 15th season before I retired.
You know, when people hear this, they're going to say, this kid was probably very savvy about life. What was it in your life in the early years that really gave you this type of insight, John?
I was 12 years old when I came home, and my father murdered my mother. And then my sister and I went through intense therapy. We lived with a temporary foster home for about a year, year and a half. And then we were eventually raised and adopted by my mom's sister, my Aunt Susan. And then my grandparents helped raise us. And years of therapy, having people help me and love me and encourage me. When you're 12, 13 years old or 14 years old and you get into magic, there might be some families that are like, well, that's not the coolest thing in the world, where my family thought it was. And they were just excited that I was into something. And so, that perspective, that complete change of lifestyle, that complete change in your entire world getting turned upside down, all of a sudden you learn that you have to adapt and you have to be okay with closure and you have to be okay with, and this is something that even today I try to, and I'm not perfect by any means. I'm not perfect at all, nor do I have everything figured out, but I try and live by a motto of, the sooner you come to terms with your reality, the sooner that you can sit back and figure out how to handle it and what's the best thing that can come out of it. And that's something that I'm thankful for, that I've learned through these years.
After you had to go through the murder of your mother, what was the first thing that you did?
Oh, interesting. What do you mean? I've never been asked that.
Well, I'm just wondering, the reaction, the pain of it, the realization of it. Obviously, you brought it into some type of focus for a young kid who's 13 years old. I'm just wondering, what was the first thing?
It's one of those things that, it's a nightmare that you live for a long, long time before you realize what that reality is. And, I remember we all stayed at our house, my grandparents, flew up, my family, during my dad's trial. And for a year, I would wake up and I would hear a pan downstairs cooking. And I jumped out of bed running downstairs knowing that I was going to see my mom there cooking eggs. And when I got downstairs, it was somebody other than that. And that reality hit me again every single day.
The other thing that I thought was interesting when I saw this story, and I've read a great deal about it, is the fact that you were caught in between. You had a father, I'm assuming, that you loved. You had a mother that you definitely loved as well. To all of a sudden have to deal with that dynamic, I don't know how you do that at 12 and 13 years old.
Yeah, because you're technically, you're betrayed by the one person that's supposed to love and care for you the most. And you know, I went home right after it happened, and for whatever reason, he snapped out of it and didn't kill me. And so you just, you know, years of therapy, you learn forgiveness, and you learn that you need to make choices that are going to impact your life in a positive way. And so, you know, people ask me all the time if I forgive my dad, and I do. And people say, well, that's crazy. How can you forgive for that? And you know what? I think it comes with first redefining what forgiveness means to you as an individual. And for me, I forgive him for being lost, and I forgive him for making a mistake. And that's enough for me to live without that cloud or burden or hate that I think about every single day of my life.
Do you have any unanswered questions?
You know what? Unanswered questions, more curiosities, you know, what does he look like? What is he doing? What is he? And I think that's normal. And I don't think anybody could answer for me or understand how I feel about that situation unless you're in my shoes. And I have just curiosities.
Have you reconciled in any way, had time to talk to him, try to get those answers?
I have not yet.
Is that by design, or do you think there'll come a day?
I think there'll come a day.
What was the critical point in your recovery and moving forward, John?
Knowing that life's going to be okay, knowing that my mom's above me, knowing that was probably one of the hardest things I'll ever do, and it was at a young age, and I made it through it. And so it teaches you a sense of resiliency and appreciation for life. And I live all the time, like, man, what would my mom do today? Or what would she think of this? Or and that means that you're going to have moments in your life that you're not proud of, and that you'll have moments in your life that you are proud of. But I genuinely love being alive, man. I'm genuinely thankful for every day I get, and I try and live that way.
What type of reaction do you get from people when you share your story with them? Because you've been on Ellen DeGeneres' show. You've talked very candidly and open about this. And I think that there's a message there, and you could probably read your audience very well because you're a motivational speaker. You know when they respond to something. What do you see as their response to this story?
If I were to put it into a theme, it's the response of that we're not alone, and it's the response of it's okay to be vulnerable and be cool. And it's okay to not always have the answer. And you know what? Life isn't a, hey, here's my 1, 2, 3 steps of progress and you will have success. No, that's not life. Life is figuring out. Life is surrounding yourself with people that lift you up. Life is admitting when you're wrong and saying, hey, look, I messed up. I'm wrong. And how can we fix this? And so, you know, my wife and I, after shows, we'll have people come up to us that it might be a completely different aspect of life, but they come out and say, you know what? This happened to me. And I used to be so embarrassed, or I used to be ashamed. But you know what? There's nothing to be ashamed about because it is what it is. Like, there's more people that go through this, and that we're not alone, and that, you know what? We can make it, which is a really cool feeling to have.
We only have 2 minutes before we have to break. Do you remember the moment, and I've talked to athletes before, like a pitcher saying, do you remember when you went from being a thrower to being actually a pitcher because there is a difference? What was that moment when the clouds parted for you over this?
22 years old. I was 21, 22 years old, and I went down to the beach in Huntington Beach, California, about 30 minutes from where I lived at the time. And I looked up at the sky, and I realized that, hey, I forgive Dad and Mom. I'm going to try and be the son that you want me to be, and let's go live.
Was football a salvation for you to some degree?
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding me? Like, I got to hit people for free and get my aggression out? It's the greatest thing ever. So I would go home and shuffle cards and kind of just be with myself. And then I get the next day I can go hit you. Oh, my gosh, it was a dream come true. I had it from both angles.
You were a kid that grew up in California, and I'm just wondering, going into Texas and playing football there where it is a religion, what was the most eye-opening thing about that?
There was nothing cooler than running out of a tunnel for a team that wanted you to be a part of them in front of 55,000 people, man, at that time. It was so cool, and it was so cool to be a part of that. Yeah, college football is no joke. It was hard, and it was an adjustment, but I knew I belonged. I knew I could last. I knew I could hang, and I knew I added value to a team inside the locker room and outside. So it was just such a proud moment to be a part of that.
In about 60 seconds, long snapper, was that something that you started? I know you played fullback and linebacker, but when did that transition come?
So my high school coach said, hey, throw this between your legs. And I was decent at it. I wasn't great. So I did it for a year in high school. Then I went to a junior college, didn't do it, didn't even work on it. And I was sending my film out, and my buddy was at UTEP, and he said, hey, we need a long snapper. And I was like, wait a minute. So I kind of borrowed a teammate's film who was a long snapper at the junior college, and I put it on my highlight tape. And then there was another teammate that hit guys really hard that we kind of looked alike. And look, no HD, you know, there's only one camera at junior college. And I kind of said they were all me. And the next thing you know, I was the starting long snapper at the University of Texas, El Paso.
John, hold on just a second. A very interesting, insightful conversation with an interesting guy. John Dornbos is with us. Of course, you probably saw him on America's Got Talent in season number 11. That was in 2016. He finished third in that competition. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Magic, and we're going to talk about his football career as we continue across the country and around the world with you on Sports Byline. John Dornbos is with us on Sports Byline. He spent 14 years in the National Football League playing with the Titans, the Eagles, and also the Saints, but had to retire because of a life-threatening heart condition. Let's talk a little bit about the Magic aspect of your life, because you got into it very early. What was the hook there for you, John?
You know, I lost my parents, and I stayed with a baseball coach for the Little League All-Stars. And their neighbor was Michael Groves. He was a 16-year-old magician. And I remember to the day how cool I thought it was, how happy it made me. And I was just a kid. And so I got into it. And Michael Groves showed me my first trick. And from that point on, it was over. And what was really cool is, as I was moving around and trying to figure out life and figure out myself, I could bring a deck of cards or a coin, and I never felt alone. I never felt out of place. I always knew that if I opened that deck and shuffled and worked on a move, everything in the outside world just disappeared, and I was just a kid in that moment, and I love that.
One of the things I've always wondered about Magic, because I love Magic, I mean, I'm so appreciative of the art form that it is that, you know, it's one thing to do something mechanically. It's another thing to kind of set the aura. What was the hardest for you?
You know, I didn't really come into myself as a performer until, you know, late college, and then even when I got out of college. And, you know, you imitate the ones that you like and the people you respect. But then, you know, being able to get on stage and talk and have that it factor, that's what you're trying to search for. And then why are you different, and what makes you different? Like, I didn't want to be like the other magicians. And then you kind of find your niche. But all that happens through just loving the art and just doing it. And then I found out that, you know, maybe I'm the inspirational magician guy who just does magic because I think it's cool, and I tell my story, and it's a great hook, and it worked out, and I love it.
You once said that Ken Sands would work with me and give me subtle hints trying to help me discover who I was as an artist, and let me tell you, it took me a long time to figure out who I was as a performer. What was that moment for you as far as when did you figure that out, what you were?
I was my rookie year in Buffalo, and a guy named Kevin Elko, who's a big-time speaker, said, hey, can you do this thing and speak for this group of bankers? I said, yeah, no problem. He goes, well, will you tell a little bit about your story and then also do a trick? I said, yeah, no problem. That was the moment where I figured out, you know what? I like the corporate speaking angle of performing. Now what I want to do is, my inspirations were Garth Brooks, believe it or not, Mike Tyson, and Carrot Top. I love those three. Garth Brooks, because when you watch him perform, he has so much fun and loves what he does so much that it just radiates, and you end up loving it too. He's the guy you want to hang with. Mike Tyson, because there's the most feared man in the world that all of a sudden is self-deprecating and funny, and he's human, and you relate to him. Like, dude, if he can do it, maybe I could do it. Carrot Top, with the way he produces his show, his use of props, his use of music, his timing, his beats. So I basically said, I'm going to go have just as much fun as Garth because I love it just as much. I'm going to go ahead and be self-deprecating and humanize myself so that people can say, you know what? If he can do it, I can do it. And if it happened to him, it's okay if it happens to me, right? And then Carrot Top, the use of music throughout my show and sound bites and the use of comedy to interject. Those were my inspirations.
The other thing, too, John, is that people love magic. I don't know what the hook is or the allure is. Can you help me out there?
Yeah, there's two types of people. And as a close-up guy, I love doing the close-up stuff in the casinos in Vegas. I love it. And you get 10 people around a table, and it's so much fun. You have two types of people, that love magic and just want to enjoy it, and they laugh, and they just love it. But then you also have the person that hates it. But they hate it because they can't figure it out, which in turn means they love it because it's intriguing to them and they want to be able to figure it out. And you can use both styles. So like the people that are trying to figure you out, that they act like they don't like it, those are the people that are watching so close, but there's a whole different style that you can do so much around them because they're too focused on one thing trying to catch you. And then there's the person that's just loving magic, and you can just do whatever you want because the misdirection, the body language, the words, and all that just works. So both crowds are the best.
You're going to find this statement funny, but there is a commonality between John Dorenbos and Jerry Rice. And what that commonality is that I've known Jerry for a long time, and I remember I was talking to him about Dancing with the Stars. And you got to understand that you're talking about athletes that have nothing to do with dancing before they get involved with that competition. And all of a sudden, they're out there in a live situation where if they trip, if they fall, it could be embarrassing. And that's so counter to the way they, you know, were raised and the sport that they were playing. And it's the same way with you with magic. You're out there as well. And you could make a mistake that millions of people could see as well. Do you see that connection there?
I understand where you're coming from, but I think as an athlete, we look at it differently. Instead, we rely on the process and that the ability to deal with pressure and the ability to come through in pressure moments and all the training that lead up to that, we implement that into different aspects of life. So when I go on stage with a trick or a routine, I know that I've gone through the process. I've rehearsed this. I've studied it. I've thought of outs. If this happens, what do I do? If that happens, I know my opponent, my crowd, my venue, and you take all these into consideration that when you hit the stage, it's game time. Just like you do on Sundays and Thursday nights or Monday night football. When you hit the field, all that's taken care of, and now it's just time to have fun and let it rip. And let me tell you what Jerry Rice did. He took everything he did and the dedication and the athleticism that he applied on the field for so long. He went into the studio, perfected his craft, where when he hit that stage and hit those lights and hit the live TV, the last thing that we're thinking of is falling. The first thing we're thinking of is, hey, I've put the time in, here I am, baby, and guess what, world? You're about to have a blast.
Yeah, discipline is something that I find is a commonality in athletes, and particularly the great ones. I remember John Michael Jordan saying to me once when I asked him about success and failure, he said, if I succeed, I want the glory. If I fail, I'll take the blame. And I think you know as well as I do, John, not a lot of people can be comfortable with that. And I'm wondering, the fear of failure, that can defeat a lot of people. Do you have that in your life or in your performances?
I think we all think of it, but I don't think we look at failure the same. You know, ironically, I had a Michael Jordan poster up at my up in my room my whole life, and it said, I fail, therefore I succeed. And it said, the whole poster is everything that Michael Jordan missed. I missed so many shots. I missed this. I missed this many game-winning shots. I missed this. I missed that. I failed here. I failed here. And at the very last line, the tagline is, I failed, therefore I succeed. And I believe in that, man. We're not all perfect. In fact, if you just have nothing but success, then how do you enjoy it? If you don't know what the feeling of defeat is, how can people respect you if they haven't seen you overcome adversity? If you haven't been kicked down and you haven't been stepped on and the world hasn't seen you stand up, dust yourself off and go right back at it and have success, well, then how do they know who you really are?
Before we go on and talk a little football, let me ask you about goals as far as magic goes and performance goes. Obviously, all of us have something we're reaching for. How about you?
Yeah, you know, so Ellen and her team have been amazing, and they've given me relevancy over time and be able to perform on such a huge platform. You've given me the opportunity to come on your show and be able to speak to the world here. You know, it's one of those things. I want to sell out venues. I want to tell my story. I have a show right now that I'm very proud of. It's inspirational. It's fun. It's my trials and tribulations. It's the hard times in life and the magic that I've learned along the way that's pulled me out of those. And it's me actually doing really cool, fun tricks. And then it's me kind of taking that symbolism and showing how life itself is magic and the things that have happened in my life is magic. And you tie all that together, you know, now I'm at the point where I can sell out, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 seat theaters, which is awesome, man. And I come in every single time. And I promise you this, the biggest compliment is when we saw Dornbosch's show, man, I feel way better than when I went in there. I was inspired. I had so much fun. And if I didn't know any better, it looked like that was the first time he has ever performed because of how much fun he had. That right there is what you're going to get.
I think let's talk some football here that very few people know much about the long snapper. It's somebody that trots out on the field on fourth down or field goal. But that's an art form, in my opinion, because it's a crucial position because everything starts with a snap. It goes to the holder, then goes to the kicker. Tell me a little bit about that position and how you made it successful.
You know, when I got into magic, because people ask me all the time, what's the similarity between magic and football? And I had to think about that. But then there's one very obvious one to me. When you learn magic and you learn a card move or a coin move, it's doing the same thing over and over and over in search of the perfect rep. And you find joy in that process, right, and that tediousness. Long snapping for me just translated that, and it just transcended that to where I literally would snap a ball in the same place, the same speed, the same time. So when I would snap a field goal, my ball spins 3.5 times. If I hit the same place, the holder catches it, puts it down, and he doesn't have to spin the ball to make the laces face out. He catches it, puts it right down. And I was very fortunate and very proud that I had a team around me, a great holder in Donnie Jones, and I was voted the most accurate field goal snapper, I think, a few times in my career for that season. But I love that tediousness of just, you know, I by no means ever compare what we do to the military or to anything of that sort, because I think those people are amazing. And but if you were to have an analogy, it's I'm a sniper, right? I have one shot to hit a target. It's a one shot, and I love the pressure of it. And I love that idea of when you go on the field, you have one shot. And every play, you have one shot to make it or break it. And that one play will always dictate your future and your career in that league.
Did you keep that position, make it simple, in other words, because you did it over and over again, cleared your mind when you trotted out on the field, and just kept your focus on what you had to do?
Yeah, but I also, you know, I think one of the things that made my football career last as long as it did is when the season was over, I left. You know, like I didn't really watch film in the off season. I didn't think about football. Like I escaped, and then I had this balance where I could go perform and have fun. But that ability to separate myself and that ability to have a peace of mind and another career and another joy, it made me love and respect and honor the game even more and made it so much more of a privilege. But it also took pressure off me because I did it because I loved it, not because I had to.
I always think about chemistry because we always hear it when we're going in to interview a team, football, baseball, you know, what about the team's chemistry? Tell me a little bit about the chemistry between you, the holder, and the kicker.
Well, it makes a big difference. And fortunately, man, I had a lot of great ones in my career. And fortunately, I was really good friends with all of them. And when you become really good friends with someone, right, and you want them to succeed and you know their kids and their family and you just want to be together for a long time because it's fun, then you're going to do whatever you can to improve your game to make that person's job easier so that the team won't get rid of that guy. And so you always look after each other. And, you know, because it's just us three all the time, me, the holder, and the punter, or I'm sorry, me, the holder, who also is the punter and the kicker, you got to be able to hang out with each other and like each other. And it starts with that, man. It starts with the chemistry of friendship first. And I was fortunate that I'm really good friends even to this day with all of them.
Yeah, none of you can be angry with each other, that's for sure. Were you surprised when you got the honorary Super Bowl ring from the Eagles?
You know, it was a situation where I was going into the season with the most consecutive games ever played as an Eagle. And I didn't play for that. It was really cool to have that record. And then when they traded me, I was shocked. But you know what? Again, it comes back to what we talked about earlier, man. The sooner you come to terms with your reality, the sooner you're going to find the positive. So if my reality is I was going to get traded, then my reality is, okay, let's roll, let's do this, and I'm going to find the positive. And I got traded to the New Orleans Saints. And had I not been traded, there's a good chance I would have died for the Saints found I had a 6-centimeter aneurysm in my upper aorta. So I went into emergency heart surgery. And it's ironic, man, that I was literally traded to New Orleans and I was saved by a Saint. And it's I'm proud to be alive.
We got 90 seconds left, and I have to ask you about Eagle fans. Philadelphia fans, it's always been said they go out to the airport and they boo bad landings. Give me your perspective on them.
Well, first of all, those landings deserve to get booed. I'm a pilot myself, so I love flying, and there's nothing sweeter than a perfect landing. But you know what? Eagles fans are the best. They are the most passionate. And, you know, Jason Kelce, if you haven't seen it, Google his Super Bowl speech. It was the best speech ever because, let me tell you, a hungry dog is an angry dog, and a hungry dog is a hungry dog, and a hungry dog wants to eat. And the Philly fans were hungry, and they wanted to eat, and they got to eat, and they deserve it. And it was an honor to play for that crowd for so long.
When you think back on your life and your career, particularly your career, is there a particular moment that in John Dornbos's mind is kind of engraved forever?
Yeah. Yeah, I had a really bad ankle injury. I tore a bunch of ligaments. The doctor told me 8 weeks, and Andy Reid was not going to put me on IR, which means that they were going to bring in a snapper to fill in for me, which means one of my buddies would have got fired to clear a roster spot to be a temporary snapper. And I said, ain't no way my buddy's getting fired because of me. So not only did I play 6 days later, it was the most pain I've ever been in, but I told the coach, hey, I'm going to go down and make a solo tackle, and we're going to snap a game-winning field goal. So sure enough, on a brutally torn-up ankle, I went down and made a solo tackle on the first punt, and then with a minute and 20 left, we went out and snapped a game-winning field goal to beat the Giants by 2. And that single-handedly, when I was in the training room, my ankle swelled up, and Andy Reid walked by me and gave me the head nod and said, I'm proud of you, kid. Most proud of my entire career.
John, I want to thank you very much. This has been very inspirational, but I'm not surprised about that at all. But I think the fact when people hear this around the world, to think about you as a person, not just an athlete, is what's going to stay with them. And I appreciate you sharing your story. You are welcome back here anytime. And if you find yourself in San Francisco, we got a seat here in the studio. I want you to come back in and sit with us for another hour.
I would absolutely love it. And if I could just tell people, go to johndornbos.com, and hopefully we're performing in an area near you, and I'd love to see you guys.
Okay, take care, John.
Thanks, guys.
Very special person, John Dornbos. Again, played college football at Texas El Paso. He was picked up by the Bills as a free agent in 2003, was a long snapper who spent 14 seasons in the NFL with the Titans, the Eagles, and also the Saints. And he was traded to the Saints, and as you heard him say, that trade saved his life. And he was a finalist in season 11 of America's Got Talent with his magic abilities. We continue on Sports Byline.